Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. It's Monday, after a very frustrating for me Sunday. I'm in San Francisco. I was in Oakland yesterday. We're going to be talking about that one. Joining us from Milwaukee, he was at the less exciting but no less interesting Bucks-Celtics game one of that series yesterday. It's Tim Bontemps. Tim, how much snow is on the ground in Milwaukee?
None, though it looks like it might be potentially snowing again right now, which is not ideal on April 29th. So
perfect.
I'd say it's more frustrating to be here than in San Francisco right now, I would say.
All right. And joining us from Bristol, Connecticut, the home base, the man is at the headquarters, sitting in a studio with our producer Kyrie, is author extraordinaire of Sprawl Ball. Is it out tomorrow, Kurt Goldsberry?
It is out tomorrow. Go to Amazon. Stop what you're doing right now. Hit the order button, and we'll thank you a million times over. But yeah, it's out tomorrow. Thanks for the plug, Brian.
There's lots of pictures.
Lots of pictures. If you don't like words, this is the basketball book for you, folks.
Can I just say, this is shameless, but I'm just going to say it. I was on SportsCenter yesterday, and I was following one of your essays, and your reads on these essays are very good. I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
I enjoyed your read.
It's a different. My James Earl Jones voice is it's a work in progress, but I appreciate it, Brian.
All right. So, without further ado, yesterday on ABC, the Warriors Rockets game drew a 5.9 rating. Is up 34% from that first round game last year on that Sunday. It had an 8.1 rating in the last 15 minutes, which is huge for a second round game in 2019. One of the most watched moments of basketball this year. It is not a surprise. It was a Sunday afternoon. Game of Thrones was not yet on. People had already seen Avengers. The NFL draft was over. It is not surprising that it would get that interest. And people tuned in to see that 15 minutes of basketball, and what did they see? I'm going to tell you what they saw. James Harden pulls up for a three-pointer. It comes after an incredible play where, being down 3 points without the ball, the Rockets trap. They don't foul right away. It was amazing. They get a steal. You should have heard the gasp. He was an audible gasp inside Oracle Arena. The fans thought the game was wrapped up. It was the exact reason, by the way, why the Spurs should have played the last few minutes of the game differently the other night, but we're not going to get into that right now. And, oh my God, it's a turnover. And here come the Rockets down the court with a chance to tie the game and send this game to overtime. There's millions of people in America on the edge of their seats. In China, there's probably 30 million people in the evening watching their two of their favorite teams. James Harden, the defending MVP, possible two-time MVP, rises up over Draymond Green, who is the, you know, one of the best defenders in the NBA, former defensive player of the year. Draymond challenges the shot. The ball goes up. It misses. Damn. But wait a minute. Here comes future Hall of Famer Chris Paul. He makes this incredible play where he senses where the ball is going to be. He comes running down the baseline, comes underneath a Warriors player, and gets an awesome offensive rebound, giving the Rockets another chance. Those millions of people gasp again. The Rockets fans, Warriors fans are, oh no, I thought we had won it two different times here. And Chris Paul looks to throw the ball to James Harden to give one of the best three-point shooters in the NBA a chance to make another dagger three-pointer, like he did the last time they were in Golden State when he made one of the biggest shots of the year. But he can't throw the ball to James Harden. Do you want to know why, everybody? Mm-hmm. Because James Harden is laying on the floor. Why? Why is James Harden laying on the floor? Because James Harden flopped.
The dramatic read is tremendous.
Okay? And Chris Paul can't throw the ball to him because he's sitting there with his hands up wanting a foul. And so instead, Chris Paul gets trapped, runs over Klay Thompson. The ball goes out of bounds. The Warriors get the ball, clinch the game. Chris Paul is so upset at not James Harden for laying on the floor flopping. He's upset at the officials for not bailing him out with that call. So he runs at the official and bumps the official. And the official ejects him from the game. Yes, it was a second technical foul, but the official ejected him from the game, I believe, because he got bumped. All right? And so now we have a game that instead of being decided by some of the best players in the NBA, what we have is millions of people talking about the officiating. And that made me sad. And I am frustrated that this officiating is becoming such a thing. I am frustrated that the Rockets and the Warriors grind on the officials every freaking call. I am frustrated that this is now how games have to end. Players looking for fouls. I don't know what to do about it, but it makes me sad, Tim Bontemps.
Yeah, well, just to go back to what you did to Kirk, your column the other day on the state of the relationship between players and coaches and refs in the NBA was spot on. And as you also wrote about after yesterday's game, I mean, there's no question that this entire series is going to be, the dominant theme of the series is going to be about the officiating and about calls that are made and calls that are not made. You're right. It is going to be a very bad look for the league. This is a series, right, that people have been talking about since last year's Western Conference Finals. I am not of this belief, but a lot of people believe the Rockets are the team that has the best chance to beat Golden State this year, just as they were last year. And instead of talking about,
did you hear that little thing where he just dropped a little thing in there? We'll go back to that in a second. Go ahead. Sorry.
It's called a tease. But instead of, like you said, talking about a really compelling and interesting game, I went back and watched the full thing this morning because I had to write about the game I was at yesterday, so I couldn't see all of it. Instead of talking about what was a really fun and interesting and exciting game and, you know, guys playing hurt and a lot of close plays down the stretch and all the stuff that was fun to talk about from a basketball standpoint, all everybody is talking about today is complaints about officiating. And like you said, that game got a massive rating and it should have been a great moment for the league. And instead, all it did was highlight what currently I think is the biggest problem the league has right now, which is a crisis of officiating on a variety of levels.
Kirk, I think you're going to have to come up with new map strategies that involve where the Rockets players attempt to draw fouls from. I think that should be your next mapping adventure.
Dude, I've already mapped that. It's not the
got to map landing spots, Kirk.
There is a – well, hold on. I got so many points on landing spots. But listen to this. You know, I've made a map about where Harden draws his shooting fouls. I've done it multiple times. There's one in the book. And the simple takeaway, Brian, is that this is a guy who draws fouls in places that nobody else draws fouls at a very high rate. We know that. We know that the Rockets are the most efficient sort of aligned team in NBA history. They know the exact margins when it comes to shot selection. That's well documented. But it also manifests in how they use the officials. And they know that three-point shooting fouls are very, very valuable outcomes for any possession. If you give a shooter like Chris Paul or James Harden three foul shots, you're giving him essentially 2.7 points, something like that. That's the most punitive penalty we have in the game. It's the most valuable outcome in aggregate that you could sort of strive for as an offensive possession. And it's unsurprising to me that this is the team that is trying to sort of exploit that. I talk about landing areas. When I was wearing a suit in Oracle Arena as a member of the Spurs front office 2 years ago, I thought that would be the biggest landing area event in Oracle Arena this decade. It might be usurped by what's about to happen in this series. And it is a little bit
Can
sad.
I interject really fast, Kirk?
Please, please.
All I wanted to say was back in Kirk's days wearing a suit, I was covering that game at my old employer, and I will never forget seeing Kirk after that game. And I don't know if I've ever seen a person angrier about maybe anything than the Kawhi Leonard Zaza Pachulia play. And by the way, justifiably, not saying not, but it was just to your point, being there for that. Like I would have never imagined that there could have been a bigger moment in this kind of a thing than that. And I think yesterday, to your point, may have actually topped it.
Well, and the last thing, thank you, Tim. I was very disappointed that day, shocker. But, you know, this is a very, we have to protect the shooters, okay? We have to. There's no question about it. But I think we need to also make sure that players aren't sort of trying to exploit that protection and draw these three-point shooting fouls, which are very, very valuable offensive outcomes, as I said. And I don't have an answer for that. I think it probably, you know, involves better language. I think everybody talking about the rules right now is talking about some vague language about the landing area. And I don't think that's specific enough. So, yeah, Brian, you started with like, oh, you got to map the shooting foul locations. I've already done that. But you're exactly right. Harden is the all-time leader in three-point shooting fouls in the NBA history already. And he's savvy for trying to do it. And it's up to the league to legislate, you know, the rule in a way that it can be clearly, interpreted. And where we at to, why this is so controversial today, at least in the basketball community, is that rule isn't drawn up really well. You have Steve Javy talking about it. It's vague. You have players talking about it. We have the Kawhi precedent. We have the Kobe precedent. We know why we have to protect shooters. But if I'm picking on anything today, it's the rule. That rule needs to be clear.
Which is what the Rockets are taking advantage of. Just like the concept 12 years ago or so when teams realized, you know what, that 21-foot shot or whatever it is, 20-foot shot in the corner is worth 3 points, and that's an inefficiency that we're not taking advantage of. The grayness of this rule is something that the Rockets are taking advantage of. In fact, in general, I would say that the Rockets are taking advantage of the ability of their players to draw fouls. Mm. They enter every game with 3 offensive strategy points. 1, to shoot 3-pointers. 2, to shoot layups. 3, to get to the foul line, and that means to exploit the official's penchant for calling fouls, shooting fouls. It is a marked inefficiency. Yesterday, the Rockets leaked a report that they had ready to go. Maybe they would have used this when they were planning this. They were thinking maybe we'll use this in game 4. Maybe we'll use this going into a game 7. But they had this report ready for game 1. It just, as it turned out, that they leaked to Sam Amick from The Athletic, and it's been leaked a couple of other places, where they had a detailed accounting of all of the shots that they, all of the times that they felt like the Warriors got the better whistle based on league, you know, analysis. And they said that last year in that, 7-game series against the Rockets, that they were robbed of 93 points due to calls that were favorable to the Warriors. And my gosh, aren't they harmed, and shouldn't we call the U.S. government, the Southern District of New York, to open an investigation? All right? And I am throwing the biggest flag I can throw on that, because it is absolutely manipulation by Daryl Morey, who I respect immensely, but it's absolute bull bleep because it doesn't take into account all of the calls that they got the other direction. How many fouls did they get where Harden was full of it and flopping, and Chris Paul was full of it and flopping, that they got those foul situations? And they, I mean, and this is an absolutely unbelievable sentence from Sam Amick's story, which absolutely was given to him by the Rockets. Talking about game 7 of the playoffs last year. 2 of the 27 consecutive missed three-pointers that did them in were ruled to have been missed foul calls. I'm going to read that sentence again, and
here's
I want
idea.
The
Don't
entire...
Don't miss 27 threes in a row.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to read it again. 2 of the 27 missed three-pointers that did them in were ruled to have been missed foul calls. They missed 27 consecutive three-pointers, and they spent a year compiling a report for how foul calls cost them that series and that game. That is manipulation. And I'm not sitting here trying to tell you that the NBA officials are not making mistakes. They absolutely are. But these teams are coming into this game where part of their game plan is to manipulate the officials. And complaining about officiating either within game or between games is part of that manipulation. And that manipulation is a well thought out maneuver by the Rockets to take advantage of a market inefficiency. Mm-hmm. And I can't believe I've spent 10 minutes here in a game talking about the Rockets where the Warriors are on the other side. Where the way the Warriors complain about officiating, I think, is a blight upon their legacy in the history of this league. And so my concern here is that this series, which very well may determine the champion, it almost certainly determined the champion last year, although the Cleveland Cavaliers have a big pride and they think they would have beaten the Rockets. I don't think that they would have, but they probably determined the championship last year. Bontemps disagrees. That's going to determine the champion this year, and we will get into that in a minute. But look, your whole childhood, you tried over and over and over to pull the wool over your mom's eyes. Do you really think she's not going to be able to tell the difference between a last-minute Mother's Day gift and something that you really thought about in advance? So this Mother's Day, don't settle for anything less than the biggest and brightest bouquets from 1-800-Flowers.com. Right now, 1-800-Flowers has great deals for mom, like 24 assorted roses for $24. And in all honesty, I'm just going to pause right here. That doesn't even sound like it's a real price. I almost think that it's a mistake because roses cost way more than that most of the time. But that's what they said, so that's what I'm going to stick with. And now they're committed to it. With big, bright, and beautiful mix of orange, yellow, and pink blooms, these roses are guaranteed to make her smile. Assorted roses are the perfect way to surprise all of the moms in your life. Don't forget about your wife, your sister, your grandmother, your neighbor. For $24, you could probably take care of everybody, to be honest with you. They'll all think you spent way more than that. Roses from 1-800-Flowers are picked at their peak from Premier Farms and shipped overnight to ensure freshness. The 24 roses for $24 is an amazing offer, but you have to hurry because it expires Friday. And honestly, I would hurry. I don't think it's going to get cheaper. Trust 1-800-Flowers to make mom feel love this Mother's Day. Order today, 1-800-Flowers.com. To get those flowers for $24, please go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code HOOP. That's 1-800-Flowers, code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Order today and save at 1-800-Flowers.com. This is in a really important series. It is loaded with star players. It is loaded with future Hall of Famers. It is going to be watched by all these people, and it is going to come down to officiating. And I'm going to tell you something. We are on the verge of getting ugly. I wrote about this last week, and then in this last month or so, we have Steph Curry showing up an official on the court. We have DeMar DeRozan throwing a ball at an official. We have Sean Marks barging into the official's locker room. And yesterday we have Chris Paul bumping an official. If you can't see the escalation that is happening here, then you're a fool. And we are headed for a black eye. And somebody, goddammit, has got to step in and stop it. And I don't know who it's going to be. And I'm sorry. And I know I'm going to get made fun of for this, but Jesus, will we stop it? I'm so sick of it. I'm so sick that this important series, these important games, are turning into a bitching about the refs fest.
Hey, Brian, let me hearken back to the 2017 second round again, where we weren't playing the Warriors, we were playing the Rockets in the second round. And if anybody thinks this is
correct,
does anybody remember our pick and roll defense that year? It was the hands up. Coming off the screen.
Oh, I remember. I covered that series too.
Yeah. So, Tim, you remember, you know, that year Harden had broke the record for 3-point shooting fouls by 2 or 3x. Him and Lou Williams were on the same team. And we had our strategy driven by the fact that they had scored, I think, 7 to 9 points a game in the first round against Oklahoma City on 3-point shooting fouls. Our goal was to not get one. And we got one, I think, in game one or two. Patty got a crappy call, like 35 feet from the basket, shouldn't have been called.
Yep.
But that was the only one of the series, in part because we were playing that defense and showing up the fact that we can't even get our hands near the guy or jump into it. And again, Harden deserves credit. That's a brilliant play. Whether it's in the spirit of the game or not, I'll leave that to others to decide.
Yep.
But this is not the first time. And again, the Rockets are playing such an analytically correct version of the game. But to Brian's earlier point, the old basketball quote that the best place to score on the court is the free throw line. Nobody has adhered to that sort of wisdom more than James Harden, who looks at the refs as marks more than anybody in the history of the league, and tries to get to that free throw line, and he does it from the perimeter more than anybody we've ever had. So this is not new, and these have been battles with the refs where they've been as violent and sort of ugly as Brian's referring to, but the officials have been such a huge part of this run for the last few years. And I do think it'll get ugly because what I think is, like, is this within the spirit of the game? And I don't think it is. And I think that's why a lot of players and coaches get mad that they have to deal with this.
I remember that series because Pop was on the court, I think, before game two or game three. And people started asking him about these reach-in fouls. And he literally stood there and did a demonstration of, like, what he wanted his guys to do. Which, you know, to everybody who assembled, was kind of amazing because usually Pop with these kind of questions would just dismiss them. But he clearly wanted to make a point on what they were trying to do. And then to Kirk's point, I mean, they did a great job of limiting that whole series. And eventually the Rockets imploded in game six. But to go back to what something both of you guys have said, like, the biggest theme of that game to me was the manipulation or the attempted manipulation of the refs by the Rockets. Like, when Chris Paul got his first technical foul, he flopped on a three and went crazy and got teed up because he tried to
D'Antoni got a tee too.
Sean Livingston and really just flew into him. And D'Antoni got a tee on the same play. And again, on that last play, like, look, part of this is, you both have said correctly, and I think Joe Borgia even said somewhere, that the rule is intentionally vague. Well, that intentionally vague is a problem when you're dealing with Houston because they, to their credit, they exploit every possible angle they can get. And look, James Harden is one of the greatest exploiters of the rules of all time. And it's a credit to him, like you said, because he gets to the line. I think he's led the league in free throw attempts six of the last 7 years as a guard, which is crazy. So obviously, they're great at this. But again, like on that last play, like you said, Brian, like James Harden jumped forward 5 feet and fell down. Like, the refs look at that and go, hey, we're not going to call that because you're just trying to make us look dumb. And at some point, the Rockets have to acknowledge the fact, in my opinion, that if you're just going to constantly go around, like Kirk said it perfectly, they, James in particular and Chris and the Rockets in general, look at the refs as marks. And if they go around and act and treat the refs in that fashion and try to fool them all the time, well, yeah, at some point it's like the boy who cried wolf. And you might get fouled sometimes on these threes, but if you're constantly trying to trick the refs into giving you calls you shouldn't get or exploit the rules in a way where you're going to get a call that's a borderline call because you make it look worse than it is, then you're going to have a harder time getting refs to go, oh, yeah, that was a foul, because they're going to be afraid that they're going to go back after the game and go, God damn, these guys got me again.
Well, as fans of the Dallas Mavericks can tell you, you can shoot your shoot free throws. You can shoot free throws to a championship, but you cannot complain your way to a championship.
That was a funny tweet by Darryl yesterday, I have to admit. That made me laugh.
Yeah.
Did you see that, Brian?
That's another thing we've got. We've got owners tweeting about officiating in other games. This was going on yesterday. Yes, I saw the tweet. You cannot complain your way to a championship. That's a phrase. Okay, I want to talk about some other things that happened in this game. There's a couple of really key strategy points that I think are going to hopefully win the day more than officiating. It was very clear that the Warriors had, even though they didn't have much time to prepare, they have been waiting for this series. They had an entire game plan ready to roll on how to stop Clint Capella's lob game, and they completely cut Clint Capella out of the game yesterday to the point where Mike D'Antoni yanked Capella at the end of the game and put Nene in instead, and that matchup allowed Steph Curry to get the three-pointer that essentially clinched the game. Terrific play there. Terrific. That's going to have to be an adjustment that the Rockets make, but they took Capella out of the game. And also at the other end, the Rockets, Kirk, I don't know how much you got to watch this game yesterday, but it was amazing watching the Warriors. They would come down the court, and their goal was to get the smallest defender on to Kevin Durant. Mm. So they would look at the alignment of who was defending whom, and they would all their players would come to the top of the key. Like, three players would come to the top of the key, and they would just run a series of screens, of stagger screens. And it almost was like they were raking back and forth. Like, sometimes the ball handler would move back and forth just to get the shuffle alignment that they wanted of the switch, because the Rockets are switching every screen. So they just shuffled it and to end up with Durant having the smallest defender on him. It was like they put it into a food processor. They put the lineups into a processor, a bunch of shuffling and screening and switching happened, and at the other side, Chris Paul was on Durant, and then they'd throw to Durant, and Durant would go to work. And the Chris Paul and PJ Tucker's entire game plan for defending Durant is to not let him get the ball over his head. Because once Kevin Durant gets the ball over his head, you cannot defend it. So they are slapping, punching, shoving, grabbing, holding, putting their hands all over him to keep that ball on the ground, and the Warriors are doing everything they possibly can to get the smallest defender onto Durant so that Durant can go to work. These are things that are going to play out in this series, and to me, that was really where the intrigue was. I wish it was more on that than the officiating.
Yeah, I mean, these are incredible teams. With, like you're saying, it's too bad we're not talking about all the MVPs that are on the court. I mean, the game has three MVPs in it. Durant is on a roll. You know, he's playing some of the best basketball he's ever played. His mid-range game is off the charts. As an analytics guy, it's like I always say, mid-range is fine if you can shoot 50 or 60%, and he's one of the few guys who can do that in volume. Closely guarded. He's hitting that little Dirk shot with the right leg up. He's got it. He's got so much to give right now, and it's so fun to watch him. But you're right. Last year, this was all about matchup science, too. Every trip down, who can get who on who to exploit the matchup they want. And right now, Durant's the hot hand for Golden State. And he had another monster game, you know, 35 points. The thing I'm watching, though, Brian, is these minutes. We've talked about the depth of the Warriors. Their bench is really nothing right now. It's Kevon Looney and Sean Livingston, and then Bogut played 5 minutes. McKinney played 9 minutes.
I mean, Livingston's giving them nothing right now, to be honest with you.
Yeah, if this goes 7 games and we're watching Draymond Green, Kevin Durant, and Klay Thompson all play 40-plus minutes for 7 games, they are going to be exhausted.
You're right. Not just this round, but also right. Going forward in other rounds.
That's what I'm saying. So watch that. It's something to watch going forward.
It really felt like this was the game the Rockets had to get, right? Mm. I mean, the Warriors are playing 36 hours after their last game. Just to me, I don't know what you guys think. It felt like that was the game that the Rockets had to get. And despite all these other calls and all this other stuff, like now with 2 days off in between games, like it just felt like that was the game they needed to get if they wanted to make this a long series. And the fact that they couldn't get that one, you have to think, even with those minutes played, which I agree are going to be an issue if it goes long, you have to think that Clay and Steph are going to be feeling better on Wednesday than they were yesterday. And it just felt like that was the one they really had to get. Like the Celtics had to get this one, I thought, to game one in Milwaukee. And, I think the Rockets are really going to rue letting that game get away for a variety of reasons.
Well, all right, that's enough on this series. We'll be talking about this a lot. I agree. Durant is on, you know, one of the things that's being obscured is Durant is on a humongous hot streak. He's probably had 4 games like this in the past, but certainly not with stakes like this. He's ever since he said, "I'm Kevin Durant," on Beverly, he's pretty much dominated every game he's been in. So I was at the Rockets Warriors game, and this sea of yellow, as there always is. Actually, it's not supposed to be yellow. I was admonished for this. It's supposed to be gold. I shouldn't call it yellow. It's gold. So it's a sea of gold. And then there's all these spots of red. I mean, the Rockets fans stick out. And I'm wondering, how did these Rocket fans get these tickets? Because some of these tickets are really good. There were some folks way low sitting in James Harden beards. They had these beard masks on. They were all over TV. And I'm thinking, how did they do it? And the answer is Vivid Seats. Vivid Seats is an online ticket marketplace dedicated to providing fans of live entertainment like NBA playoff games with experiences that last a lifetime. With Vivid Seats, listeners can watch their favorite teams and artists perform in person. They help find their seats to any of their favorite events, including NBA playoff games, concerts, theater, and more. They offer great prices and an easy purchasing experience. So go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. Our listeners can enter our promo code HOOPS, H-O-O-P-S, to receive 10% off that first order, and all Vivid Seats confirmed orders are backed by a 100% guarantee. Go support your team at home or on the road with Vivid Seats. Yesterday, Bontemps, you were at the Celtics game one upset. You know, the thing about the Celtics all year is that they've had the highest upside, in my opinion, in the East. They do, you know, man to man, they have superior talent than the Bucks, but they do not play, you know, the Bucks play typically a very organized, machine-like, efficient attack, and you get impressed with the way they play together. But overall, the Celtics should be the better team. They just haven't been. And yesterday, they were the ones who had their act together more. What did that teach you?
The simple way to sum up that game for me is that everything that people around the league have doubted about the Bucks all season all came to fruition in one game. People questioned whether Mike Budenholzer's system would be able to hold up against higher competition in the playoffs. People questioned whether the supporting cast that you mentioned is not the same level of talent on paper as these other teams atop the East would hold up against higher level competition. People wondered how Giannis would do when a team could really zero in on him during the playoffs, though most teams don't have a guy like Al Horford, who was incredible yesterday. You put all those things together, and it was a pretty disheartening game for the Bucks. As I think our colleague Malik Andrews had in her story, and other people also said to me, like, this basically couldn't have gone much worse for the Bucks for a first game. They shot the ball terribly. Eric Bledsoe looked terrible again against the Celtics, just like he did last year in the playoffs, just like he did in two of the three regular season matchups this year. The other players, supporting guys, did not play well other than Nico Mirotic. And Al Horford did an incredible job on Giannis, and really the Celtics just bottled him up all game. So, I expect the Bucks to play much better on Tuesday in game two. Just looking at that game, there wasn't a lot of stuff that happened from the Celtics side that wasn't replicable. And I think they're going to be in a lot of trouble.
One of the things I saw, Kirk, was, really the Bucks, their offense works much like the Hawks did under Mike Budenholzer. Their offense works when they share the ball and move the ball. I don't know if it was what the Celtics were doing or if it was just the Bucks freezing up in a moment. They were absolutely playing straight isolation basketball yesterday, and that just completely undercut the entire thing that they needed to do offensively. I don't know how you saw it.
Yeah, I mean, Bontemps is right. It was like the exact worst sort of outcome. I think Jalen said it on the post game show on ESPN yesterday. But one of the things that when the Bucks play breaks down, Brian, like you're saying, they stifle a Giannis drive, let's say, and the kick out comes and there's no 3-point shot. There's not a lot of guys who can dribble, pass, and shoot out there. And I think that showed up. I mean, and the one guy that was Eric Bledsoe, whose nightmare was revisited from the Boston series last year. Terry Rozier outplayed him again. I mean, Eric Bledsoe's 1-for-5 in 25 minutes with 6 points. That's not going to get it done. The starters, Brook Lopez, Bledsoe, Sterling Brown, just didn't show up. I think they were combined 3-of-17. And then on the other end of the court, everything went right for Boston. And in a weird way, they sort of play to Milwaukee's weakness. The Boston offense is very sort of jump shot oriented. They don't need to get to the paint. They don't need to get to the line. If their jump shots are going in, they're very good. And Milwaukee is content to let a lot of teams shoot jump shots. And we saw Kyrie making shots. We saw the team shooting, I think, 42% from three. And then the thing that I've always wondered about Kyrie Irving is can he make the players around him better? Can he create those shots? And he had that 11-assist game yesterday. This isn't a Kyrie Irving I remember watching in Cleveland in the playoffs, mostly because LeBron was on ball all the time. But this was the exact kind of game that Boston would have wanted. Their jump shots went in. Kyrie shared the ball. And then Al Horford played the best defensive game of his life and stifled the likely MVP in Giannis. And so when Boston is right, they're making jump shots and they're playing great defense. And yesterday that was the combination that won them this game.
Bontemps, you have the stats on Bledsoe versus the Celtics this year. I think you mentioned them.
In the one game Milwaukee won comfortably, I think they won by 13, Bledsoe was 7-for-9. The other three games combined, he was 6-for-23. And like Kirk said, especially with Malcolm Brogdon out, whose loss was really felt yesterday, because he is a guy that could actually get into the defense and make a play, as opposed to Sterling Brown and Pat Connaughton and some of these other guys who are out there. There was a play in the second quarter when Bledsoe got to the free throw line, stood there for about 4 seconds, nobody was around him, and then he passed the ball. And you just knew from that point on, he was just not going to be a factor, and he wasn't at all. And if Milwaukee wants any chance of making this a real series, he just has to be better. He has to be a lot better. Because if it's just Chris Middleton and Giannis against the Celtics, they don't have any shot in this series. They just don't at all. So that to me, he's been the bellwether guy from them from the start. And to me, that's the guy you watch in game two. If he's not a lot better, unless the Celtics are just horrible, which, like I said, they made shots yesterday, but also, like, I didn't think they did anything that was unsustainable. So they're going to need Bledsoe to be a lot better if they want to even the series up and give themselves a shot going back to Boston for game three.
Well, this gets into my cone of uncertainty that I've talked about with the Celtics all year. Their variance in play is enormous, but at the top end, they could win the East. At the top end, they could give the West champion, I assume it'll be the Warriors, everything they could handle. At their bottom end, yep. They were in trouble in the first round. So I don't know how it's going to go. It's obviously, if you're a Celtics fan, you're incredibly encouraged by what you saw. As Kirk said, Kyrie being everything they could have ever dreamed as the floor leader in that game, but it could completely flop around, which is why we're going to tune in. I mean, that's going to be interesting. Now, Bontemps, you have already indicated that you have a strong you're not in agreement that the Rockets Warriors winner may be the champion. You have pretty strong feelings about the East, and I'm going to give you the floor now to say them. I know what they are, but I want everyone to know what they are.
I said about a month ago that I thought two teams could beat Golden State in the finals and in the playoffs at all, which are Milwaukee and Toronto. And I got a lot of slack for that because a lot of people said, well, Houston's the best team in the league besides Golden State. I haven't really thought that all year, in large part because, as you saw, like one thing I didn't say earlier, as you guys mentioned in this game, without a Trevor Ariza on the Rockets, the one guy the Rockets never replaced, without Trevor Ariza, I thought that the Rockets were a significantly worse team, and they have no one to guard Durant. There is a team, however, that has a lot of people to guard Kevin Durant, and that's the Toronto Raptors, who I think are going to win the title this year. The Raptors.
Hold on. We have a prediction. He just said the Raptors are winning the title. Just wanted to get that. He's on the record. The same man who in October said the Lakers weren't making the playoffs. He has said that the Raptors will win the NBA title. Go on. Just wanted to make sure that was on the record and denoted. Go on.
Since August, ever since they traded for Kawhi, the Raptors have been solely focused on doing everything they can to be as good as possible in May and June. And that goes to sitting Kawhi during the year. That goes to changing starting lineups all over the place. That goes to changing the way they played. That goes to giving Pascal Siakam more and more opportunities to do things outside of his comfort zone throughout the year. Trading for Marc Gasol. All the various things that the Raptors did throughout the year were all geared toward being as good as possible now. And if anybody who watched that game on Saturday night against the Sixers saw, the Raptors are ridiculous. And Kawhi Leonard in particular has gone up a couple of levels, at least, from where he was in the regular season. I know Kirk obviously knows Kawhi's game as well as anybody, given his time in San Antonio. And he just looks incredible at this point. And to me, the Raptors this year actually remind me of the 2014 Spurs. I mean, I mean, the reason I say that is because that team was on a singular mission all year. I don't think that the talent is exactly the same, though they do have Kawhi and Danny Green.
I will say this, going back to that, let me just say something about the Spurs. I will say this. Obviously, it was an incredibly disappointing loss for the Spurs in 2013 when they lost to the Heat in the finals. Game 6, Ray Allen, and they come back and LeBron carries in Game 7. Tim Duncan misses the one-foot layup that kills the Spurs' chances. I was assigned to go cover Spurs training camp that next year, and the story that I was assigned to get was, go have the Spurs talk about their summer of misery after losing in the finals. And I was like, boy, this is not exactly an easy assignment. The Spurs don't like talking about the weather, much less talking about the greatest disappointment in the history of the entire organization and all their careers. So I kind of like tiptoed into the Spurs facility on the first day of training camp, thinking like this was going to be a real chore and that I was going to have to ask all these questions. And as a non-beat writer, that I was going to get, thrown out on my ass, and I couldn't believe it. Pop wanted to talk about it. Tim wanted to talk about it. Manu wanted to talk about it. Tony Parker, who was still a little bit tipsy off getting drunk after winning the European Championships with France that summer, wanted to talk about it. I couldn't. I had an overflowing notebook of the Spurs talking about their disappointment and misery coming off of that that loss. And so Bontemps is right. They absolutely approached that season with nothing but blood in their mouths and fire in their eyes to destroy the Heat, which they ended up doing resoundingly 6-7 months, whatever it was later. That's my only thing. Like, I understand what Tim is saying, because as I have talked about on this podcast before, when I went to see the Raptors play in the preseason, I was gobsmacked about how great they looked. And I never want to overreact to a preseason game, but I couldn't believe, I said, this is a fire-breathing monster. And they have gone through the regular season only preparing for the postseason. I mean, I see kind of the comparison he's making. The only thing that I think is a major difference is those Spurs guys had proven that they were champions. Now, Kawhi and Danny Green, oh my gosh, they were on that Spurs team. So here's your link to that Spurs team. I just don't know whether this group of players, who is largely, other than those two Spurs guys, unproven and susceptible to collapse based on their background, I just don't know if they've got it in them. But Bontemps, I admire you coming out and saying it. I'm not saying that that you're right or wrong. I don't know if the Raptors have the same intestinal fortitude, but we're going to find out, I guess, Kirk.
We're going to find out. And the Sixers are a really good opponent who have played pretty poorly, in my opinion, in that game one. But yeah, Kawhi is a closer. The difference between this Raptors teams and the previous ones is he's a guy when he's going, you could give the ball to with 4 minutes left in a tie game and get good looks, high quality shots. He's not going to back away from the moment. He likes it. And then he'll D up the best player on the other end too, whether it's Harden or in this series, somebody like Jimmy Butler gets going, or even Tobias Harris. They can throw so many big, long defenders. Now you have Danny, you mentioned that. Pascal Siakam also now is playing huge minutes for them and gives them just another Swiss Army knife on defense. All game, not just at the end of the games. But, I mean, combined, I think, you know, Siakam and Kawhi were 28 for 38 and just had 70-some points.
28 for 38, yep.
And that's not going to happen again. I mean, kudos, but these are not the Raptors we were talking about in years past. Siakam was there, sort of, kind of. He wouldn't have been starting, and Kawhi wasn't there, and Danny wasn't there, obviously. So these are not the same Raptors. And to Danny's credit, he's been really good all year and has been there in the playoffs in these 13 and 14 series that you guys are alluding to. So I think the Raptors are a different animal. I think we saw a little bit of that in game one, and I'll be curious to see if we see it again in game two. Can Embiid show up? He had problems with Marc Gasol. Can Ben Simmons get it going? This is not a great matchup for Philly, and if Embiid and Simmons aren't going, what are we looking at? How are they going to win a game? So I'm looking for those guys in game two. Bontemps, I forget who you said it was. It was Bledsoe in the other series. I'm looking at Ben Simmons and Embiid in this next game to see if they can get it going to get a fire lit under Philly's chances.
Well, Tim, you know, they've been saving, in one way or another, saving Kawhi for the entire year. And the Kawhi that we've seen in this postseason, man.
Yeah, I mean, I think people probably should, the people who criticize them at times for having Kawhi sit out games during the regular season should probably recuse themselves, right? Because at the end of the day, if this guy's going to play like this throughout the playoffs, everything that the Raptors did during the regular season is going to be justified. Because the other night, I mean, he was just incredible. And to your point, Kirk, Marc Gasol, the guy they traded for in February, just completely stonewalled Embiid the whole game. And Embiid basically gave up trying to get into the paint after a while when Gasol was out there because he just couldn't move him. Part of that's because of his conditioning. Part of that's obviously because of his knee, which is clearly not right. But yeah, he's got to, I mean, 5 for 18 is not going to cut it. He's got to be way better than that if they want any chance. And he's probably got to be the best player on the court. And I just don't know if he's capable of doing that right now. And if he can't do that, the other matchups are not great. And I'm just not sure how they match up with Toronto at that point.
And Toronto is the deeper team. But, you know, Philly's, you know, the starters for Philly, this is the first time they've been hit in the mouth in a long time. They've generally been terrific when they've been playing together, even though it's been small, a small sample. And they get outplayed by the Raptors starters. So the Philly, to have any chance to win,
Pascal
has got
and Kawhi
to
outscored them by themselves.
Yeah. For Philly to have any chance to win, their starters have to win big time because their bench is thin, especially compared to the Raptors bench. I have a rule, and it sounds corny, and I apologize. I've been accused of being corny many times in the past. I will many times in the future, but I don't overreact to game one. I'm getting old now. I've got gray hairs in my head, and I can talk about playoff series I was covering before Twitter. And I've just seen too many playoff series where game one happens and everybody goes up in arms. And then by game three and a half, nobody can even remember what happened in game one because the series changes. So
can I interject with a corny rule as well?
Yes.
My corny rule is that if you lose game one, you want to get blown out. You want to lose a big way because that puts the fire in. Like talking about that Rocket series against the Spurs, nobody remembers. Everybody remembers the Game 6 collapse by the Rockets, but nobody remembers they kicked our behinds in that Game 1. They won by like 20 or 30 points. People were shoveling dirt on our team. And, you know, that lights the fire onto you for Game 2, especially if you're at home like Milwaukee is. You want to lose bad. You don't want to lose by two and sort of be like, oh, if that one shot went in. You know, if you really need to make adjustments, you want to get blown out like I think Milwaukee did. And maybe Philly. When you get punched in the mouth, you know, you come back hard in that game too. And if you don't, sometimes you just like, oh, we just need to make a couple more shots, and you don't really take those adjustments as seriously as you need to.
I don't know about you, Andrew, but I am really enjoying Goodyear's campaign in these playoffs because they get to show the Akron Wingfoots. When I grew up in Akron, Ohio, home of Goodyear, I heard about the Akron Wingfoots. Some of the great players in the 40s, 50s, 60s era played for the Wingfoots. They were a historic team, and that's because Goodyear has been supporting basketball for generations. And that's why this time of year, basketball's playoff run, Goodyear wants to be a major part of it. And it's where the players are more driven than ever and they go further. So why wouldn't you want Goodyear to do the same? It's smart advertising. Goodyear knows that performance is everything, whether it's at home, on the road, or on the court. So when it comes to choosing tires, let Goodyear.com help you choose what's best. Goodyear has been a supporter of basketball for decades. Been a supporter of great performance tires for decades. So Goodyear.com. Goodyear is more driven.
All right, let's spend a couple of minutes on the other series, sort of the outlier series. All the other series have played, and then Portland, Denver. Tough turnaround for Denver after playing the 7-game series. By the way, I felt like the entire Warriors organization was just tired at the end last night. Like, I expect a very light practice today because they were just tired from their turnaround, 36 hours. Denver, San Antonio, very emotional victories for both of those teams, Portland and Denver. But Portland's had way more rest. Kirk, can Denver maintain and also – I don't know what cancer can do with the shoulder injury. I don't know if there's been an update this morning that I've missed, but I don't know if he's even going to be able to play. So that means they'd be down two big guys coming into this series against Jokic, even though they looked much better in their first-round series. What are you looking for in this?
Well, you know, Denver didn't look like they were ready to play in the playoffs for the first game and a half or so of the Spurs series. They looked like that young team with no playoff experience. Jamal Murray looked lost. Mike Malone didn't look like he had a good game plan, and then it flipped. And they played really well. And the role players, you know, that you don't expect much from on the road, they were making shots and big road wins. They're really good. Obviously, Jokic and Murray are their two best players. But when Gary Harris gets going, they're really good. You know, Monty Morris has something to give them. I think they can keep it going. I think they're going to surprise people in this next series. Brian, I think you honed in on one of the key points. We're already out with Nurkic. If Kanter's banged up, okay, how are we even stopping Jokic in the series? What's the plan? Obviously, Kanter doesn't come
in. Myers-Leonard, that was your time.
Yeah, Myers-Leonard, Zach Collins.
Zach Collins, yeah.
Yeah, these guys don't come in with sterling defensive reputations to begin with, and now they have arguably one of the hardest defensive assignments at that position in the NBA coming their way. Who's hot. He's learned how to play playoff basketball, and he gets other players going, which is unique from that position as well. So if they can't slow down Jokic, I think, you know, the rest of the country is going to wake up to the idea that, oh my God, the Denver Nuggets are actually pretty good. So I think this series is about you're exactly right. Can what's left of the bigs in Portland do anything to slow down Jokic?
Pontemps, can Lillard keep shooting like 40% on 35 footers? Cause I don't think that he can, but I mean, he's proven people wrong for his whole career.
Yeah. I mean, I get where Kirk's coming from, and I agree. Like, whether Kanter plays or not, this should be a series where Jokic feasts on the opposition. But I can't bet against Dame Lillard at this point. I bet against him in the last round. I picked the Thunder because I thought without Jusuf Nurkic, they were not going to be able to have enough to beat the Thunder. And all Dame did, to your point, was shoot, I think, what, 8-for-12 from the logo in the series or something. Just absolutely absurd even before he hit that ridiculous shot to win the series. And I, you know, at the end of the day, I'm just going to lean on the fact that I bet on Damian Lillard making plays down the stretch to win these games. I do agree with Kirk in that the Nuggets succeeded in getting through the first round and getting through that, getting through the challenge of winning a playoff series and being the favorite team and dealing with that and fighting through and winning. But they didn't look that impressive in doing so, and I just think, you know, them trying to stop Damian Lillard is going to be another matter entirely, and I just think that Lillard in the end will be too much for them, even if Kanter can't go, which, by the way, he said yesterday, I went and looked, that he said he's questionable for game one, but I haven't seen an official note from the team.
Well, I love Ennis, but he says a lot of things.
Yes, he does.
I also feel like Denver is not, and they could prove me wrong and slap this across my face in 7 days. I don't know if Denver is equipped to win in Portland. They did win game four in San Antonio, which was a season turning win. But Portland's a tougher place to play. And that's going to be the thing. If they really need to get ahead in this series and make Portland lean on their home court, because if Portland comes back 1-1, even 1-1, they're going to feel really good about it. But I am looking forward to watching that series to see if Lillard can stay hot, because Lillard is on the kind of streak right now. He's kind of like a hot guard in the NBA. Really, you see it in all postseason basketball, especially college basketball. You get a hot guard, there's, you know, special stuff can happen in the postseason. So I'm really just anxious to see if Lillard can keep it up. All right. Well, Kirk, you've got to go do book promotion.
Oh, yeah.
So congratulations on Sprawl Ball coming out tomorrow. You can get it at Amazon, at any of your fine retailers. It is a beautiful book. It's the type of book that you want to put on your coffee table, if nothing else. Just buy it and put it on your coffee table. It'll, A, make you look smart. And B, it's a beautiful thing that people can just flip through. They can open to almost any page and learn something. So good luck with that.
Thanks.
Bontemps, good luck with trudging through the snow. Snowshoes are available on the corner. don't forget that Bontemps has now predicted that the Raptors win the title. I'm teasing you to have fun with you, but I am really anxious to see what Toronto does. It'll be a disaster for television ratings, but it could potentially be good for the NBA.
I was gonna say,
thank you.
I might get fired if that.
Canadian television ratings will be great, though. Let's be
through the roof. They will. Thanks for getting up early with us, Andrew Hahn. Although I got up early too. I'm on the West Coast. I don't even know why I'm thanking you. Thanks for Kyrie for spinning the dials and sitting there and giving emotional support to Kirk as he's in their studio with you. We'll be talking to you later this week. Thanks for listening to Hoop Collective.